Welcome everyone to this interview where I'm super excited to be speaking with my good friend Dr. Avery Neal. And we're going to be talking about the relationship between trauma and boundaries. How do you learn to set healthy boundaries? And particularly, how do you navigate toxic relationship dynamics as you're learning to put those boundaries in place? To give you a little bit of Avery's background, Dr. Avery Neal is a practicing psychotherapist, international author, and speaker. In 2012, she opened Women's Therapy Clinic, which offers psychiatric and counseling support to women. Avery is the author of If He's So Great, Why Do I Feel So Bad? Recognizing and Overcoming Subtle Abuse, which has been translated and published in 12 languages. Her articles and interviews have been published on Oprah.com, American Counseling Association, Daily Om, Best Self Magazine, Hitch Magazine, Bustle, Pop Sugar, PKWY Magazine, and her courses have been taken by over 18,000 people worldwide. So Avery, firstly, welcome. Lovely to have some time with you again.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So we're talking about the relationship between trauma, past conditioning, and how that impacts our ability to set and to protect boundaries in our life. Now, I'd love you to talk a little bit about how past experience really shapes that ability to have healthy boundaries in life.
Absolutely. So it's really huge to look at how our past experiences have shaped our current ability to set healthy boundaries. So certainly, you know, past experiences from childhood or even in adulthood can really inform sort of how we interact in the world and in our environment and in our relationships in the current moment. So when we're talking about sort of past experiences that may have been less than ideal, and certainly traumatic, of course, is a part of this, then what we do is we develop certain survival skills in order to deal with it and to create kind of the best environment we can for ourselves. And so these survival skills may not necessarily be really healthy for us, but they're just a way of coping with our environment and getting through it. So you can see this a lot in abusive relationships or in unhealthy family systems where a child or a person will develop ways to survive their environment. And then what happens is they continue those patterns or they continue those coping mechanisms into their future. And so even though their environment may change, their relationships may change, their surroundings may change, they're still holding on to those same coping mechanisms or skills, and they no longer maybe serve them.
Just I think also worth bringing in some of our previous interviews, we talked about your work on subtle abuse. And I was just thinking that often we don't always recognize trauma as trauma. What I mean by that is unhealthy patterns that we've got so normalized to that we don't see that impact. And I'd love you just to say a few words around some of the subtleties sometimes of the trauma and the abuse that we can experience.
Absolutely. So this is really an important thing to understand because it's actually sort of the more subtle aspects or the less overt forms of abuse that cause a person's self-esteem and confidence to deteriorate. And then that makes it increasingly difficult to set healthy boundaries for ourselves. So a lot of times what we see is sort of this questioning and second guessing ourselves and sort of feeling like maybe I'm crazy. I'm the one that messed up, or I am the one that is at fault because if I hadn't done this or that or the other, I wouldn't be experiencing this this real pain or this struggle in the relationship. And so what happens in the case of these more subtle patterns is that because they are subtle, you know, the person maybe finds an insecurity and just digs at that, or uses sort of gaslighting as a way to make you think, you know, you're losing your mind. Those types of things, those, you know, start to make us really question ourselves and kind of what's going on in the whole relationship. And so then that puts us at an increased risk for not really sort of standing up for ourselves and saying, hey, this is wrong. This isn't working. This is not healthy. And in addition to that, you can almost think of this as like grooming. So, often when we're talking about grooming, we're thinking of it in terms of like sexual abuse and a victim becoming sort of groomed over time for the bigger abuse to occur. That's exactly what we're talking about. It's these sort of underhanded ways of sort of undermining us and making us feel bad about ourselves, while also simultaneously giving sort of seemingly love and care and support. And so it really keeps us off balance. We don't know really what's going on and what to believe. And so in the context of trauma, trauma, if you think about it, it really is a boundary violation. So something that we think is going to be safe, whether that's a relationship, whether that's a situation, whether, I mean, even, like we have laws to sort of provide, some predictability in society, right? So the same thing is true in our relationships. And when the boundary is violated, that's when we typically experience trauma if it's a significant violation.
It's also interesting, I think, that when a boundary is violated, we feel it. And of course, the challenge is when we're in a toxic relationship, we become trained to override that feeling, right? Or we get gaslit for having that feeling. So it's almost like that inner alarm system gets dampened.
Exactly. Absolutely. And so, let's talk for a moment about like the short term sort of implications and then the longer term ones, because I think it's really important that people know. So in the short term, when our boundary is violated, we may have sort of this nagging feeling. We may feel sort of a knot in our stomach, tightness in our chest. We may feel like we're sort of confused and questioning what's going on, but maybe thinking, well, maybe it's just me, or maybe I'm misunderstood. And we may even be consciously aware that we're sort of putting our own needs aside for the sake of keeping the peace in the relationship or not making the other person angry or upset. So those are sort of the short-term mind and body sort of aspects of this type of dynamic. If you're looking at the longer term aspects of not setting healthy boundaries, and certainly in a toxic or abusive relationship, that's when we start to see what you're describing, which is sort of the numbing, the detachment. We become sort of a shell of ourselves because we've basically sort of given up when we've tried to assert ourselves. It doesn't work. And so we just start to sort of turn inward. And as we become sort of more increasingly helpless and sometimes more hopeless, that's when you start to see things like depression, anxiety, addiction as a way of coping. That's when you also start to see some physical health greater physical health conditions. So insomnia, other sleeping disorders. You can also start to see pain syndromes, gynecological problems in women, even cardiovascular events increase with this kind of long-term exposure to trauma.
Yeah, of course, one of the challenges here is that we get so normalized to the patterns that we have, right? And so if we've got used to our boundaries being violated, then over time, we stop putting the boundaries in place in the first place. Or to put it another way, if the boundary should be like out here, and then gradually we have less, kind of, we get more and more eroded or more and more normalized not having the boundary, but one starts to go, why is it that I always end up in all these toxic relationships? And I think sometimes it sounds a bit cold to put it like this, but of course, we are the common denominator in all the relationships in our life. And I guess that's a message of that can be, I guess, frightening, but also it's empowering, right? Because if it's partly us, then we can change.
Absolutely. So, some of this is luck, right? Like we only know what people reveal of themselves once they reveal it, right? And so whether that takes a day or a year or 10 years, sometimes we don't have all the information. But as you said, once we have all the information, it's what we do with that that really does determine our overall patterns. So, for instance, with some of these toxic relationships, once you start setting a boundary, it's really important to look at how the other person responds. And so, if we're used to sort of shying away from the boundary setting because we're afraid, and we're afraid of the punishment, we're afraid of some sort of big fallout or an escalation of the abuse, then we really are sort of giving that other person more and more power, while we become, increasingly helpless. So one of the things that is incredibly important and empowering, to your point, is to, instead of shying away from the boundary and feeling afraid of it, causing an escalation, we in fact do set the boundary, and then we just watch how the other person reacts. So their reaction, if we learn to embrace that as just more information, then it doesn't become quite so scary and overwhelming. It's like, okay, now I know this, now I can see this, and it's more information to guide me in, next steps and what I need to do moving forward. So you start to look at it as a gift rather than something to be avoided. And certainly in a healthy relationship, we can express our needs and our feelings and, ask for what we need moving forward. And even though the other person may be a little bit defensive at first, you kind of talk it through and you figure out some sort of resolution that's respectful for both parties. In an abusive or a toxic relationship, that is not the sequence of events. So, when you establish your boundary and you ask for what you need, there's a punishment, there's a rejection, there's a withdrawal of affection. There is all sometimes sort of this blackmailing type behavior. I mean, there are all kinds of intimidating behaviors. There's basically an escalation of punishment. And so that is more information. So instead of, being so afraid of it, if we can kind of shift that perspective and reframe it to, okay, this is a gift because now I have more clarity and insight as to what the dynamic is here. And with that information, I can make other choices.
So let's spend a little bit of time defining what a healthy boundary looks like, and then we can explore a bit how healthy boundaries may, or an effective boundary may then be with a toxic person. But let's start more generally. Like, what are some examples of an effective and a healthy boundary?
Sure. So in a healthy relationship, and by the way, a lot of times if you've been in toxic relationships, what is considered like normal, basic, standard, healthy behavior seems like, oh my God, gosh, that's too good to be true. I can't imagine it. So for anybody that's watching that has a history of sort of mistreatment, I think that these things are just basically what should be expected. They're just sort of the fundamental ground rules in any relationship. But in a normal, healthy relationship, we should not feel fear. We should feel free to say what's going on, how we feel, and then asking for what we need. So, a really good pattern for that is to let the other person know sort of your account of things or your take on things, and then letting them know how it's making you feel, if you're needing to set a boundary, and then asking for what you need. And that last piece is really important to be clear because, your partner or, your coworker or whomever is not a mind reader. So, kind of taking the legwork out of it for them to try to guess what it is that will make you happy, it's much more effective to go ahead and say, here's what I would really appreciate moving forward, or here's what would make me feel more connected to you moving forward. And then give the other person the opportunity to kind of do the same thing. Let you know how they're feeling and ask for what they need moving forward. And then part of your work is to not get defensive, but to remain open to what they're telling you that they need. And so, this in the healthy relationship, this process just kind of goes back and forth until you can kind of figure out a mutually agreeable resolution.
Part of what I think you're saying here is really important. I think it's important people hear it, is that it's a reciprocal process, right? And so there's an expression of one's emotions and needs. There's space for that to be heard. And there's also a mutual expression of maybe completely differing emotions and needs, right? That's also given space.
Yes.
And so what you're describing is a balanced power dynamic in the relationship.
Exactly. There should not be an imbalance in power ever, because where there is fear.
Right.
One person is afraid of the other person, and that's not okay. So, going back to some of our patterns too, it's not uncommon if someone's experienced an abusive relationship or an abusive childhood to hold on to their own patterns of shying away from expressing any need in the relationship. And that's not necessarily fair to their current partner, for instance, because maybe their current partner really wants to know what will make that person happy in the relationship, or what will make that person feel comfortable. And so it's really sort of incumbent upon all of us to speak up in our relationships so that we are giving our partner the opportunity to support us in the ways that we need to be supported.
Now, one of the challenges can be that we're in a relationship where the dynamic has been the same way for many, many years. And then we start to do our inner work, right? And we start to realize that this dynamic is not healthy, it's not sustainable, and we start to change the dynamic. The challenge is the other person is like, what the hell? This is not how we do our relationship. So what are some of the ways that can help? What are some of the things that can support setting a boundary with someone where we're now restating the terms of the relationship?
Absolutely. So this happens a lot. So I'm glad you're bringing it up. I think the important thing is to address the elephant in the room. Hey, I'm growing and I'm learning all kinds of things, and I'm feeling really excited about it. It's, helping me in my life and in my healing. And my goal here is to have this with you, or this in our relationship. So maybe that's more connection or closeness or affection or whatever it is, that whatever the goal is in the relationship, let your partner know, hey, this is what I really want with you. And ask your partner, what is it that you want? What are your goals? What do you want out of this relationship? And start seeing if you can find alignment. Interestingly, a lot of times when we're first dating, these are conversations, or we're early on in the relationship, these are conversations that happen, sort of with regularity about, our hopes, our dreams, what we want, and what we want in a relationship. And then over time, those conversations just sort of fall by the wayside as we get busy and, kind of do other things. But these are really important conversations to kind of continue having throughout the course of the relationship. And so again, you can watch how your partner reacts to it, and it gives you more information. So if your partner is open to it and receptive to it, and if your partner feels like you're open to meeting their needs as well, then you're establishing sort of a healthy boundary there, that is mutually agreeable. If your partner responds with some sort of punishment or threat, that's something to pay attention to, right? Because the only hope for change is if there's accountability, and if someone takes, responsibility for their behavior. Without that, it isn't going to change. A change isn't possible without that, right? So that's what you really want to be paying attention to, is what is the other person's sort of reaction, and looking at that, because that's going to give you a lot of information about what your future looks like.
Let's take the worst case scenario. Well, what will probably feel in the short term like the worst case scenario might be the best case scenario in the long term, but what may feel like the worst case scenario in the short term, which is that this all falls on deaf ears, or this actually results in an increase in the toxic behaviors of the relationship. How does one start to navigate that? Because that can be really difficult, right? It's like one's excited about their inner growth, and then they try to bring that to the relationship, and actually they just get more of what they're trying to move away from.
Absolutely. So that's an indication that usually what you've been feeling in the relationship is actually sort of maybe spot on, and your intuition has been telling you this for a while. And so if the person responds that way, then that's, certainly gives you a lot more to go off of in terms of what's possible in the relationship and not. And, A lot of times, if we're somebody that wants to keep the peace, or we kind of shy away from conflict or don't want to get into it, a lot of times when that person responds negatively, the reaction is sort of maybe literally and metaphorically to kind of put our hands up, like, whoa, 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 I don't want to go there. Never mind, never mind. Just like forget it, right? So if you're feeling the need to do that, something is wrong. So I would encourage everyone then to have sort of the ability, again, literally or metaphorically, to say, actually put your hand out and say, stop. I'm not going to allow you to speak to me this way, or I'm not going to engage with you when you get like this. So you really are sort of giving that actual nonverbal cue that, hey, there's a boundary here and you're overstepping it, and I'm no longer tolerating it. And then, distancing yourself from the situation and starting to sort through your own feelings around this and how you need to move forward in the most healthy and empowered way. And of course, there's a lot of work that goes into that.
Yeah. There's also, it just struck me as you were talking that if we've become normalized to a toxic relationship dynamic and we put the effort into trying to move on and then we find ourselves being drawn into staying, I think one of the things that also can underlie that is a kind of core self-esteem issue, which is that this is all I'm worthy of. This is all I deserve to be treated like this. Can you say something about the role of self-esteem in these dynamics and in the importance of in a way reclaiming one's authentic, genuine self, like reclaiming one's power in the journey?
Absolutely. So this is kind of why I'm so passionate about studying psychological abuse, because psychological abuse is truly the underpinning of all forms of abuse. And so the psychological aspect and the subtle psychological aspect is actually the most difficult to recover from. So, for instance, you often hear women who have been battered or physically abused say that recovering from the physical abuse was not the worst part of it. The hardest part of it was moving forward and trying to recover from the psychological damage that was done while in one of these relationships, because it does. It undermines us. It undermines our confidence. It undermines our sense of worth. This is something that causes a lot of emotional and physical deterioration if we've been in one of these abusive or toxic relationships for a long time. Even in a short period of time, it's amazing the damage that can be done. So it also makes that psychological abuse component makes it more likely that we stay in the relationship, because we start to believe all these things. We start to believe that, okay, like you said, I am not so great, or who else would want me, or those types of things. I'm so lucky that this person will tolerate me. And so it creates more dependency on the abusive person or on the toxic person. Making it less likely that we will get out of the relationship. So that, I mean, it is really, really important to understand that if you're experiencing that, if you're feeling poorly about yourself or unworthy of better treatment, that is an indication that something's very wrong. That something has either happened to you in the past or is going on in your relationship that is causing you to feel that way. Because in a healthy relationship, your partner is supportive and sort of your biggest fan and your cheerleader and wanting good things for you and wanting you to be your best, happiest self. And if that's not occurring and your partner is tearing you down in overt or covert ways, that's certainly something to be paying attention to. And it's also more likely that when you do sort of confront the issues and what you need moving forward, you're going to be met with resistance and even an escalation of the toxic behavior.
What helps us Well, actually, I'll ask the question slightly differently. Knowing that, you and your team do a lot of work with particularly women who have been in abusive relationships and reclaiming that themselves on the other side. When you're sat with someone and you can see that their perspective on themselves has really got skewed, right? It's like it's all sometimes the way that I experience it with clients is that I realize that as a relatively neutral party, the way that I see them is very different to how they see themselves. And you can sort of see that negative self-image in it. And you can see it on a kind of macro level in terms of how they sort of see themselves, but all the subtle ways that it comes in and the subtle rejections and putting oneself down and so forth. What are some of the tools that you're using to help rebuild that self-esteem? Like some of the sort of practical pieces, some of the sort of perspective shifts, or some of the homework you're giving to people. Like, what are some of the building blocks to start to rebuild that self-esteem?
Absolutely. So, I mean, there's so many pieces to this that are really powerful and quite healing. So, I think the first step is sort of addressing the trauma first, because a lot of times people who've been in this type of situation, they're so dysregulated, and the anxiety, the fear, the hypervigilance is so acute that getting to the point of sort of that self-actualization, feeling more confident in themselves, all of that's secondary. So I think starting with sort of that inner emotional regulation and working through the trauma and often some of the PTSD type symptoms, that's kind of the first component. And then it's really about doing some of that inner child work and looking at, when was the last time you did feel good about yourself? And was there a time that you felt good about yourself? And for some people, there's not. And so there's got to be some grief work around all of that, and then rebuilding from there. And so even looking at, what are the things that you enjoy? What are the things that make you feel at peace? What are the things that make you feel happiness when you're immersed in them, and really helping the person to establish sort of an identity for themselves. That's then kind of that becomes sort of the North Star, and everything can kind of fall into place from there. But this depending on the level of trauma and when it started, this process can take some time, but it's certainly well worth it.
Yeah. One of the things that I love about doing therapeutic work, and I'm interested in sort of your reflections on this as well, is the moments where this is maybe a very British expression, where the penny drops, or maybe where like the lights go on, where someone has the recognition that either recognition that they find their courage and they realize that they can do it, or they suddenly see themselves more cleanly and not through the filter of that history. And I'm not quite sure what my question is. I suppose my question is perhaps two things. One, the things that you recognize help people find those moments, but also what becomes possible because of those moments, right? It's like it's almost the magic or the secret source of great therapeutic work when someone realizes, holy shit, like I can do this and like this can change.
Absolutely. I mean, it's one of the most beautiful things to witness when there's a shift, and usually there's a real emotional response to, like you said, this is all of a sudden it just all clicks, and it's this real compassion, like a deep compassion for oneself and what you've been through, and really this love, fostering this love for yourself in the present moment and moving forward. That's the best way I know how to describe this sort of shift. It's like all of a sudden there's this overwhelming compassion, and realization or recognition that I'm worthy.
Right.
And it is profound. And then that's when you really can start to look at what are things that are in alignment with that worthiness, that support that worthiness, that can strengthen you, that can facilitate more growth and more optimism and increase the quality of life. That's when that part of the work begins to occur. So it's a beautiful thing. And interestingly, when we're talking about PTSD and trauma work, a big part of that is not only regulating the person's internal response, but it's also starting to build their future in a way that feels really good to them, that feels safe, that feels predictable, that feels hopeful, and it is what they've always really wanted. And kind of working backward from there and figuring out, okay, what components need to be put in place in order for you to have this wonderful life that you really are starting to envision for yourself.
As you were talking, I was formulating a question that then I withdrew because I realized I couldn't answer the question, which was a question around how do we create those moments? Because what my reflections were, and maybe you've got an answer or I haven't, but my reflection was that often those moments, at least it seems to me, they kind of come out of nowhere sometimes, right? It's like sometimes the penny that drops or the light that goes on. As the practitioners, sometimes we think we're steering towards a really big moment of insight, and it's like a comedian that drops a joke that just goes nowhere. And then other times it's like you don't think you've even said anything particularly insightful or something particularly important happened. And then
Right.
suddenly, I'm just sort of interested in your thoughts on those moments and how to
Absolutely.
celebrate
So
them.
the yeah, well, you said it so well. It's so funny. I mean, sometimes people will come back and say, "Remember when you said XYZ or whatever?" And I'm thinking, "No, I don't remember saying that to you at all." And but it was a pivotal point for them, right? And so and then sometimes you're kind of leading somebody somewhere thinking that they're just right on the edge, and then it just falls flat. So it's exactly what you say. But I think more than anything, it really is about each individual, because some people are really able to do the healing work when they're able to connect with more of a spiritual side of things. And when I say spiritual, I don't know necessarily mean religious, although for some people that resonates. But what I mean is more of sort of a connection to a higher power and a connection to oneself. So even being able to separate like your soul or your spirit or your essence from your body, which is just sort of your form. A lot of people are really able to make some profound breakthroughs doing that type of work. And other people say, I have no idea what you're talking about, And so, some people love doing the inner child work, and other people go, this feels awkward and doesn't resonate. So there are just sort of different things that speak to all of us. And I think one of the beautiful things about the therapeutic relationship is sort of exploring that together and sort of seeing where the client leads you, and what helps to kind of connect the dots. Because this point that you made about how the client views themselves, there being a disconnect between that and then what the outside world sees or what you as the therapist see, it's equivalent to sort of like body dysmorphia that someone with an eating disorder has, right? And so they can't see themselves clearly, and so it perpetuates the problem. And so when you're able to sort of bring everything together and it becomes an alignment, it's magic.
Yeah, it's something about, I think sometimes, clients will say things like, but you're being so kind to me. And often my response is, well, not really, because I was actually being really quite tough with you 5 minutes ago. It's that I'm seeing you objectively. And the problem is, I suppose, when someone's so used to seeing themselves through a negative lens, the kind neutrality appears like kindness, if that makes sense.
Yes. Absolutely. And that also kind of speaks to sort of the traumatic bond that often happens in these abusive relationships where, when the person becomes so accustomed to mistreatment or these overtly abusive episodes, whether they're whatever form of abuse, that when that abusive person or when that toxic person is being nice or, like you said, neutral, they're so flooded with gratitude and relief and feelings of closeness that it really sort of bonds them to that abusive person. But that being said, that same pattern of the victim of the abuse or the survivor of the abuse, it extends well past the relationship being over, where they are not accustomed to someone being consistently kind and consistently supportive. And so it does feel sort of shocking for a long time. And a lot of times they're uncomfortable with it, they don't believe it. And there's usually a pattern of having a really difficult time receiving. They feel guilty, they feel like a burden. And so that's another piece that has to be kind of worked through that, wait a minute, that's not what's going on here. This is a healthy thing for you to receive. It's a healthy thing for somebody to want to be kind to you and to support you.
Yeah, I'm just thinking as you're speaking, in a way, it's like the sign that really good healing is happening is our relationships start to feel unfamiliar, right? If we've been consistently in toxic relationships and that's become the norm, and sometimes people will say, oh, it just feels really scary and unfamiliar, that's often the sign that one's moving in the right direction.
Exactly. Absolutely. And there is a vulnerability that comes from that. So a lot of times people will feel very exposed, very raw, and have a difficult time kind of getting, excuse me, adjusted to the new relationship dynamic or a healthier relationship dynamic. And I always just say, give it time. Keep going.
Suck
As these
up the unfamiliarity because you spent years taking pain, so you could take some unfamiliarity, right?
Exactly. This will become your norm. And it's a wonderful, beautiful thing.
Yeah. So we're nearly out of time, Avery, but maybe let's just have a few sort of practical starting pieces, right? So someone who, whether it's an intimate relationship or it's even the recognition of family relationships or friendships, that one can see from this conversation that boundaries need either establishing or reinforcing or defining. What are some things that can help one get started?
Absolutely. So I think the biggest takeaway that I would like to say is that don't look at the other person's reaction as sort of it's often the case that we try to manage someone's reaction, and that's what is determining our behavior. Their reaction, their negative reaction, or overwhelmingly scary reaction is what we allow to drive our behavior. And so long as we're doing that, we cannot have a life that is authentically ours. We just can't, because we're allowing someone else's behavior to really determine how we move about in the relationship and in our lives. So the biggest component that I really want people to keep in mind is that it's most important to figure out what you need in your life and allow yourself that space to imagine what it would look like if your external life reflected your true, internal feelings and what you really wanted, and allowing that to kind of be your North Star. And then as you set boundaries with a person or people in your life, instead of worrying so much about their reaction, just observe it. It's more information. You don't have to react to it. You certainly don't need to acquiesce. Just observe it and look at it as more information about whether or not this person can move forward with you on your path or not.
Yeah, it's almost like people tell us who they are by how they respond to a boundary, right?
Yes,
Like, is the response
exactly.
one of love and respect, or is it one of no, their needs are more important than our boundary?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And do they threaten? Do they put it back on you and blame you and try to tear you down? Do they make you question and second guess yourself or make you think you're so unreasonable to where then you get caught in this whole shame cycle and spiral within yourself? So yes, those are all, big red flags.
Yeah, it's almost like what you're saying is if they try and make you responsible for their behavior, that's the ultimate red flag, right?
It is. And often that's so clear to us when we're talking about like physical violence, but then when it's psychological violence, we're not recognizing that that's actually what's happening, right? Because it's not so overt. But the pattern is there, whether the physical violence is happening or not. It's the classic, this person hit me because I deserved it because I said XYZ. No. So even if there is no physical violence, if that's happening emotionally, it's still not okay, and it's still unhealthy, and it's still something you need to be paying attention to.
Yeah, fantastic. Avery, for people that'd like to find out more about you and your work, tell us where people can go and tell us some of the things you have to offer.
Absolutely. So, two websites, AveryNeal.com, AveryNeal.com, and then womenstherapyclinic.com. So we offer individual sessions, virtual and in person, as well as different courses and different tools to help people in terms of their healing and their journey. We support a lot of women going through depression and anxiety, various life stages and transitions, not only associated with abuse. And then we also have just added a component where we help people with genetic screening so that they can then take it to their doctors if they're needing psychiatric medication to sort of kind of cut down on the trial and error that a lot of people experience when they need medication, but they're afraid to start it because they don't want to be a guinea pig, and rightfully so. So we have that available as well for anybody who's looking for
Well, like that's a whole new interview I want to ask you about there. And
it.
also, Avery, your book's a great starting point as well.
Oh
So thanks so
yes, oh
much. Yeah.
yes. Thank you. Yes, I appreciate it. And yes, my book is If He's So Great, Why Do I Feel So Bad? Recognizing and Overcoming Subtle Abuse, and that is available through the website and on Amazon.
Fantastic. Avery, thank you so much. I really appreciate you. I appreciate your work. Thank you for today's interview.
Thank you, likewise.